It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the latest on the Hollywood writers' strike now in its second week, and how it's affecting our entertainment and the entertainment industry. First, conservative groups have taken aim at libraries across the country in an effort to remove some books that might expose some children to material that they deem inappropriate or even harmful. Facing tight budgets, some are willing to go so far as to threaten to defund our public libraries. But the library can serve an important role as a cost-free shared public space that provides opportunities for social and civic engagement, as well as learning. And libraries are just one example of the types of social infrastructure that strengthen our communities and reaffirm our interpersonal connections. The quantity and quality of our parks, coffee shops, places of worship, civic centers, and other shared public spaces can have some significant impacts on our quality of life. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. How do you feel about the social gathering spaces in your community? What do you love about your local library, your parks, event spaces, or other public areas? Give them a shout out. How do you use them? And do you wish you had more of them? Anybody want to make the case that they wish they had less? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Kleinenberg is the Helen Gould Shepherd Professor in Social Science, a professor of sociology, and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. He's the author of the book Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with some definitions here. How do you define social infrastructure and where do we see them in our communities?
Yeah, it can be kind of a wonky term, so let's make it simple. When I say social infrastructure, I'm referring to the physical places that shape our interactions. And the argument I make in my book is, you know, when we invest in them, when we design them well, when we build them well, when we maintain them, when we program them, we get all kinds of returns to our collective life. And when we fail to do those things, we become a lot more likely to hunker down, you know, stay home, be on our screens, hang out with people who are pretty much just like us. It makes our collective life a lot less interesting and rich.
The physical places that shape our interactions. What have the virtual places that shape our interactions? What impact has that had on our social infrastructure as you see it, Eric?
Well, you're talking to a father of two teenagers, so I might have a bit of a bias about that these days. You know, it's funny. A few decades ago, there was a social scientist named Bob Putnam who wrote a book called Bowling Alone. It was a very famous book about the decline of communities in America. And his complaint was, you know, Americans used to go out together and go to the big movie theaters and walk in the streets together. And he said, now we just sit in our living rooms and each family watches a TV show. Right now, an entire family watching the same show sounds like a collective utopian fantasy because most of us, we just have every individual on their screen. So I think there's a lot of social stuff that happens on our screens. I'm not a Luddite. You can find me on Twitter today. You know, you can find me on Instagram, all those places. But I don't really see the digital stuff as social infrastructure. It's communications infrastructure. But really what it works best at is helping us to find each other in real life. And here's how you know that that's true. Think back to when the pandemic was starting. Mm-hmm. We were all together on our screens, but we were home and it felt miserable. We missed each other. We missed gathering. We shouldn't take that for granted.
Yeah, the pseudo sense of sociability that you find in a Zoom connection. It's hard not to relate to. And when you talk about the family sitting around to watch a show as a utopian, I think of families that are sitting around with their laptops and headphones all watching whatever it is they want to watch so they don't have to watch what mom's watching.
Or even worse, when it's at the dinner table and you can't have a common conversation because people are sneaking their phones underneath. I mean, again... The screens don't have to be terrible and they can help us find each other. You know, if you live in a rural area, if you live in a small town, it can be hard to get out and find your people. There's some people, you know, who find lifelines to their community that can help them, you know, figure out how to deal with a rare disease or, you know, deal with a stigmatized identity that your parents don't honor and respect. And the internet can be great in those situations. But I think even in those cases, at the end of the day, our relationships are so much more rich and meaningful when we find each other in physical places. And really crucial for me is when we share activities, we do things together. And I also think doing things together is a way that we can start to get at this horrible polarization that's, driven our country apart. I know my understanding is everybody in Wisconsin just gets along perfectly. You don't have this division issue there in Wisconsin, I think, right? But the rest of the country, we're really struggling with this.
Eric Kleinenberg, our guest, director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. And we want to know what you think about your social infrastructure in your community and how it shapes your life and your family's life at 1-800-642-1234. And Eric, you've made the case before that these kinds of spaces can help reduce polarization and even inequality. How does that work?
Well, let's start with polarization. There's no way we're solving the problems of Wisconsin or of this country on Twitter, where we basically get together and yell at each other. I think that the best chance we have for dealing with our cultural differences is to do different kinds of things together and begin to build relationships and recognize our common humanity. In the book, I write about the athletic fields as places where a lot of that work happens. I'm one of the many millions of parents in the United States who spend an inordinate amount of time watching their kids play sports. And it means that every Saturday or Sunday, I'm spending time with the same set of people that I don't really have that much to do with in the kind of most parts of my life. Like, we're very different kinds of people. We come from different places. We have different religions and ethnicities and maybe value systems too. But one thing we do share is that we love our kids. And we love to watch them play these games, and we're happy to spend in huge amounts of time doing it every weekend. And so, we start our relationships by talking about what's happening on the soccer field and our boys. And over time, we're able to share a little bit more. It doesn't solve all of our problems. We still sometimes disagree with each other, but we recognize that we're human beings. And, these days, unfortunately, that's a start that we need. So I think polarization is a problem where we're not going to get at it by persuading each other on the internet. We're going to start to deal with it by just doing stuff.
Your book, Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric Kleinenberg, our guest. How does social infrastructure then go towards reducing inequality?
Well, it depends on the kind of social infrastructure you have. In my book, I'm really primarily interested in more accessible, democratic, publicly shared spaces, and I'm less interested in more exclusive social infrastructure. I mean, social infrastructure can be polarizing, and it can add to inequality. Like, if you're in a place where your main social infrastructure is the country club, you're going to get to know people who are just like you, who are from your social class, maybe who share your racial or ethnic identity. And you're probably going to hoard opportunities, and that's going to generate more divisions. But if the main place where you spend time is a library or a schoolyard or a park or a playground, it's possible that you're going to start to build relationships that take you to different places. I'm a sociologist, as you said, and we understand in the social sciences that a lot of our life opportunities, and especially job opportunities, come from our weaker ties, not from our family members and our best friends, but people who we get to know who help us discover something that we didn't know was there for ourselves. And so we have to think about where we connect, with whom we connect, what kind of infrastructure we set up to build those relationships. That's why I become such a big proponent of places like libraries and parks and playgrounds and athletic fields. They take us into the social worlds that we might not otherwise find.
Libraries, parks, playgrounds, and athletic fields with our guest, NYU sociology and social science professor Eric Kleinenberg. How important are these spaces to your life and your interactions with others, to your understanding of others, to the relationships that you have and how they are built? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. How often do you go to your local library? And what about your communities, parks, or other public gathering spaces? How important are they to you, and what do they mean to your family? 800-642-1234. Our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg continues coming up on Central Time. You're with us on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg, a professor of sociology and social science, as well as the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. With us today to take a look at the value of our public social infrastructure in our communities. And we're talking about libraries, parks, recreation spaces, athletic fields, and where we meet each other in the physical universe. Join us and tell us about it. Do you wish you had more public spaces where you are? Does anybody want to make the case for defunding these spaces or devaluing them now that you have Facebook or Instagram? 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas at WPR.org. And Eric, I'd be interested in getting your take on some of the attacks we've seen on public libraries recently and how that could negatively impact some of our social infrastructure. Eric?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you cut out there.
Oh, yeah. I was just wondering about some of the attacks we've seen on public libraries, the content they contain, and what that means to our broader picture of social infrastructure.
You know, I find this very worrisome. When I wrote my book a few years ago, libraries were a place not only that we shared physically, but a place that I think we shared in terms of our values. They're a neutral space. And one of the pleasures I had doing research for the book is I went to libraries in conservative communities and also more progressive communities and found that people really celebrated their libraries. They liked hanging out in them. They supported them for the most part. And I have to admit that I have been shocked to see such a strong attack on an institution that stands for and represents what's best about an open society and a democratic culture. And I'm very concerned about this, effort to ban books and to banish ideas, and in some places to defund the library as a shared institution. So I see this attack as being part of a more sweeping effort to make America less inclusive and less democratic. It feels authoritarian to me and dangerous, and I don't know where it's going to go. But I will admit that I see it as a very dangerous sign in our society right now.
Other than being a self-professed lover of libraries, what role can we play in supporting these social infrastructure places that are open to everybody?
Well, first I think it's important for us to remind our representatives and also our fellow citizens how important it is to have a place like a library. And I often ask people to imagine that the library did not exist. Imagine there was no such thing as a library, period. And, in every community that's got a library, instead it had an Amazon store or an Apple store in that same space. Imagine what your community would feel like if there was no free place where you could walk in, feel welcome, get access to your cultural heritage without spending a dime, and have someone, a librarian, ask you, how can I help you? And promise to respect your privacy and dignity. Libraries play such an important role in our culture. In the pandemic, they provided Wi-Fi access for people and classes and all kinds of things that they did remotely to support communities throughout the United States. I honestly don't believe that we would be capable of creating the library from scratch if it didn't already exist. I think the idea is so out of sync with the way that we organize society these days. We wouldn't know where the profit incentive was and which businesses would want to support it, and we'd probably say it was unrealistic. But the reality is, we have this extraordinary institution. The American public library system is extraordinary itself. We have big libraries in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and we have small libraries in rural areas and small towns and suburbs, and we shouldn't take them for granted. Should not take them for granted. So I guess the question is how should we support them, and how should we make sure that they're getting the resources they need to serve us? I think we're asking the wrong questions in too many places. In New York City, where I live, the mayor just said he wanted to cut the library budget by tens of millions of dollars to invest more in police. And for me, that means we become a less decent city and a less attractive place to live.
Eric Kleinenberg, our guest, we go to your questions and comments now about our shared spaces and the importance they have in your life and your family's life and the interactions you have with others in your community at 1-800-642-1234, where Jeff in Superior is standing by. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Well, I'm a good guy to talk to about this because if you want to engage in activities out in the outdoors, we have, kayaking groups. We have running groups here in Duluth Superior. We got rock climbing groups. And one of the things I want to mention, we have three universities here. So sometimes they have speakers that come and you can listen to them give a speech or a talk on a certain topic or a book or something. And then during the intermission, you get to meet people in your community, you know, and visit with them about the topic. I mean, there's so much to do that for families or individuals up here in Duluth Superior that there's really not a bored moment. You can go bowling or watch a movie, and you're always interacting with people up here. Four Starbucks in Duluth. So, I mean, you always meet new people. It's exciting to live in Duluth Superior.
Jeff, I appreciate the call. And you live in New York City, Eric, so much the same. But I think here in Madison, Wisconsin, having the campus in my backyard is something sometimes I can take for granted because some of the public spaces that it offers, not just to the students or faculty, but to the entire community.
I think that's right. And, you know, obviously the University of Wisconsin is an institution that has been under assault in previous administrations in the state, and a lot of people there feel nervous about its future and its standing. Things are better there now than they were a few years ago, but we're seeing big fights over, you know, what we like to call public goods, right? These things that we create that are that come out of taxpayer investments because they're things we build for ourselves and that make our lives better in so many ways. So I think a big question for people who live in an area that has a lot of activities and has good social infrastructure is, are they as welcoming and accessible to everyone as they could be? Are there people who live in Madison who don't feel welcome on the university campus for whatever reason? Are there people in Manhattan who don't feel welcome in the branch library or in the playground? The United States does have a history of having built amazing social infrastructures that have signaled that some people really belong there and others don't. And sometimes we do that without even realizing it. So I think every institution and every community needs to ask, you know, what it's doing to make sure that it's keeping the social infrastructures updated and well-maintained and programmed, but also accessible.
Back to your calls now with our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. Cindy and DePere is joining us. Good afternoon, Cindy.
Hi. I have 2 points I'd like to make. One is that the libraries are more than just books. They offer so many things that people are unaware of. And our library, particularly the Long Green Bay area, a lot of kids go there because there's nowhere else for them to go. And it keeps those kids out of trouble. And my second point is that banning books is not a solution. You have a choice. If you don't like the library, you don't have to go. If you don't want to read a particular book, you don't have to read a particular book. You have the right to choose, not the right to tell people what to do. That's all I
Cindy, thank you so much for the call and the perspective. And when I think of banned books, I think of the movie Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, which just came out, is hugely popular right now. And the fact that I got to read that book as a kid and how eye-opening that was to me and how some folks were upset that that book even existed on the bookshelves. And that it's just a small part of what the library can be for people, Eric.
Look, I think... First of all, I heartily agree with both the points your caller just made. And second, I think, yes, books that feel threatening to some people offer lifelines for others. And I think we need to make sense of that and recognize that. I talked to so many people who told me that as children, the library was a place where they could feel at home, even when the world around them sometimes felt hostile. And many pointed to librarians as being people who really saved their lives because they helped them learn about themselves without judging them or intimidating them or asking them intrusive questions. They respected them as as people. I mean, I can't tell you how meaningful it is for children to get their first library card and to recognize that, that library card is an acknowledgement of their presence, their identity, their belonging. And it gives them this kind of feeling of being part of a community that's larger than themselves. Not only they recognize, but they learn that when they take out a book like Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, or like Curious George or Harry Potter, they have to take care of it and return it because there's other kids in the neighborhood who want that book when they're done. And if they don't do it and the other kids don't do it, then they won't be able to get the next Curious George or Harry Potter book. And so we start to learn about what it means to be in a reciprocal relationship in the civic realm with people who are part of our democratic community. And there's not a lot of places that do that the way a library does. So there's just a lot at stake when we start banning books and defunding great public goods and social infrastructures like libraries. And I think it's a moment where all of us who share the values of an open society need to stop taking them for granted and start fighting back.
Eric Kleinenberg, thank you so much for your time and wisdom this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and social science and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. He is also the author of the book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Sorry we didn't get to all the phone calls, but you can still sound off on this topic and certainly something worth revisiting again, ideas@WPR.org. He was with us today to help explore why our shared public spaces like libraries, parks, and civic centers are important to our communities, as was clear. Now, coming up after the news, Hollywood writers are on strike. What does it mean for the ongoing story of organized labor in the U.S., and what does this mean for our constant streams of entertainment? Don't touch that dial. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we talk about our favorite trashy movies. Everybody's got one. But now we're in the second week of the first major Hollywood writer's strike since 2007. And the rise of streaming platforms is being assailed by the Writers Guild of America, and they argue that the studios have not increased their compensation appropriately. We're going to dip into the organized labor side of this first, and then we'll talk about the impacts on what you can and can't see on TV and in the movies, now and going forward. And you can join the conversation if you like. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Michael Childers is a professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. He's an expert in labor unions, collective bargaining, production standards, and labor management relations in union environments. I spoke with him earlier this afternoon. Let's start with how the ways in which we watch TV and movies have changed, obviously. But how has that changed the livings of the people who are making it, Michael?
That's a great question because it has fundamentally impacted them. When you look back at the last time that this union ended up having to strike during their negotiations, DVD sales were a huge thing, which, of course, now don't even exist. Structurally, streaming has remade basically all parts of the entertainment industry, and for writers, it's no different. And a big point of contention and something that needs to yet be worked out is exactly how compensation works in terms of the royalties that they are able to earn for shows that they've already worked on.
Well, one of the ongoing themes I think I've seen in the stories I've read is that these writers seem to be employed less often and finding jobs can be more difficult than it used to be. So how do they compensate that and find a way to make a living with what they're doing?
That again, is a result of sort of the change in the dynamic in terms of how shows are being sourced and produced. When you think about traditionally network series, you're talking about 20 to 24 episodes per season. So once a writer was in a writing room on one of these major shows, they pretty much knew they had 40 plus weeks worth of work lined up for the year. if you think about some of the more popular streaming series, they can be as little as 4 to maybe 12 episodes per season, which means that, yeah, in a real sense, writers have to scramble kind of gig to gig, because even if they do land these positions and are in these writing rooms, it doesn't even last a calendar year.
So Michael Childers, our guest professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. You mentioned the previous strike, 2007, 15 years ago. It lasted 100 days. From what you've seen so far, could we see this one last as long or if not longer?
Of course, anything's possible, and you hate to prognosticate. But I would say that it seems that both sides are fairly entrenched in their positions, and the writers are bringing up issues around artificial intelligence, for example, that have yet to really be negotiated in a major national contract. So unfortunately, yes, right now I know people understand, obviously, the immediate impacts. But as it drags on, your possible outcome could be, the delay of fall programming.
What's the concerns over artificial intelligence and what it could mean for content creators?
Well, that's one of really the two major points that are remaining. And I guess I would say it this way. In general, workers are always concerned about being replaced, whether you're working in a factory or at a fast food restaurant, right? And the writers are no different, and they really see the large language model AI as a potential threat in terms of, what it means to their future livelihood. And what they're asking for basically is some very stringent constraints on how and where this technology can be used in their profession.
Who's in a better position to weather this labor dispute and this ongoing strike? Would it be the writers themselves, or would it be the studios?
Well, it's pretty easy to do the math and figure out who has more money. So from that perspective, obviously, I mean, the studios, especially, and it's kind of ironic, it's the streaming services that are probably best positioned for a longer holdout, in that they have a lot more shows in the can, so to speak. They have a lot more programming that's already been created that they can continue to, met out as they need to try and keep, things fresh. They don't have to go straight to reruns, right? At the same time, I think the writers are very determined to try and get some concessions around both, like we talked about, the AI, and also around the size of writer rooms and when they can use these so-called mini rooms for show development. So it could be a protracted struggle.
Would you explain the mini rooms for us a little bit, Professor Childers?
Sure. And now we're getting into really the inside baseball. But basically, in the past, producers or showrunners have utilized what they call quote unquote mini rooms, where it's just a handful of writers who are perhaps like typically was used like for a show that's under development, where maybe they haven't ordered the actual series yet, but they want to create a pilot, maybe the first couple of episodes, just to try and pitch it. And more and more, the studios are saying, well, yeah, this model seems to be great, so we'll employ less people for a shorter time. And yeah, that's something that the writers are pushing back on. We were talking about the last contract. Back then, I mean, one of the things they negotiate for is sort of like a minimum pay structure, a minimum salary scale. And back at the last strike, about a third of the writers would come in and be making at the minimum scale. And now it's up to half. So it kind of gives you the sense for how much things have changed for them.
Yeah. Michael Childers, our guest professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison. And what are some of the reverberations we've seen so far in the TV and movie industry? And are there other unions that are stepping up to support the Writers Guild of America?
Yeah, I think absolutely all the other entertainment industry unions have stepped up. I mean, I've heard of instances where, for example, the Teamsters, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, who we traditionally think of as like truck drivers, bus drivers, that sort of thing, they refuse to cross picket lines. So in places where the writers have set up pickets, the Teamster drivers have refused to make deliveries. There's definitely a lot at stake in terms of both for the producers, because the next two contracts that are going to be up that they're going to have to be negotiating are both with the Directors Union, and also with SAG-AFTRA, which is sort of your on-screen talent. So obviously they're watching with close attention and obviously trying to offer their support because they understand that they're going to soon be in bargaining as well.
Yeah, I saw a video of Mandy Patinkin at the picket lines yesterday, and he had a Princess Bride sign, "You killed residuals, prepare to pay," and he was joined by Bob Odenkirk, who at one point was one of the writers, but probably know him best as Saul Goodman from Better Call Saul. So this This plays out in a much bigger picture going forward. What are some of the things that you're watching for next, Michael?
Well, again, I think from a labor relations perspective, it's interesting to see how they're able or what they're able to work out in terms of a resolution to the AI question, because this is something that's on a lot of people's minds. And obviously, you know, what the writers are able to achieve is going to have impact that's going to be watched closely.
And what can I do or what can a consumer do as part of this labor dispute? Is there a way to are we in danger of crossing a picket line by streaming, or is there a way to support the writers?
I mean, again, I think the writers, I mean, I think a lot of people are following this on social media just because they're interested in what's developing or how things are going. I mean, in terms of actual solidarity, I'm guessing they probably have websites, et cetera, set up to assist writers, especially if the strike drags out longer in terms of mutual aid and support. So,
could this be a moment where artificial intelligence does step in and start generating content for us to consume?
Well, I think we've seen already examples that it is being used, right? In terms of advertising, I know there was an article this year about a famous Formula One driver who had an article that said it was an interview of him that was in a magazine. And he said, "Yeah, that's impossible because I've never spoken with you folks." And they later fessed up, "Well, yeah, it was generated by AI." So it's happening now. It's just about the ways in which it's going to be regulated and constrained.
Michael Childers, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's always a pleasure to be on Central Time.
Michael Childers is professor in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, and I talked with him earlier this afternoon about the labor union aspect of this ongoing Hollywood writer's strike. Next, we'll hear from an entertainment reporter about how this is affecting TV and movies, and you and me, the consumers. And you can join us now over the phone at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how the strike is affecting the writers themselves and us, the media consumers? Are you paying close attention to the shows and movies that might be affected by it? How's it affecting you? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about the Writers Guild of America strike now in its second week. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You understand where the writers are coming from and their need for more support from the entertainment industry? Joining us now to talk more specifically about the impact on the entertainment industry is Wendy Lee. Wendy's an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times, where she covers streaming services like Netflix, Amazon Prime, and Apple TV. And Wendy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to thank you for sticking around and listening to our conversation with Michael Childers from the UW-Madison. And I wondered what you'd have to add in terms of what you're covering and what you heard from the professor there.
Well, I think that one thing also important to note is, in addition to the writers that are being affected by this, and is also that the impact of the strike is also affecting small businesses. Small businesses like prop houses, florists, caterers, businesses that, you know, supply services to some of these productions, and when they shut down, it can adversely affect the local economy also in the L.A. area.
Yeah. How much of L.A. is an industry town? How much of the economy there is dependent on the entertainment industry?
It's a lot. You know, I mean, hence the team that I'm on. It's called Company Town because we cover the entertainment industry. But yeah, I mean, they're, you know, I talked to some businesses last week, and some of them, like the majority of their revenue comes from serving these productions. And when they shut down, they, you know, they have to dip into their savings, or some of the small businesses are pivoting to live events. So there is also a local economic impact.
The other thing that Professor Childers mentioned was the contracts for SAG-AFTRA and the Directors Union, and how what's happening now may bleed into or have some impact on what's to come with those negotiations. What are you seeing, Wendy?
Yeah, so my colleague, Anusha, she has reported on the DGA negotiations and Directors Guild of America negotiations. And I think historically, the historically the DGA has been able to come to an agreement with the studios, and so people are looking to the DGA to see what happens with those negotiations and how those might affect the negotiations with the writers and the studios.
Wendy, you have a recent piece in the LA Times focusing on the particular ire being targeted at Netflix. Why? What is it about Netflix specifically that has so many writers being critical of and part of this writer strike?
Well, you know, I think that Netflix is seen as a pioneer streaming. And, you have to think back to the last time when there was a writer strike. That was 2007. And back then, Netflix was, a business mailing DVDs, but today Netflix is known as being this pioneer streaming that has a huge library of content. And with that, when Netflix was building up its business, one of the things that Netflix offered to writers was it was seen as a leader in terms of this effort of greenlighting scripts to series without having to go through a pilot process. And in return, Netflix had planned to keep all these shows and later movies exclusively on its platform for its originals. But, because it was all on its platform, those shows and movies, wouldn't be available anywhere else. So, for example, Bridgerton, the only place you can watch Bridgerton is on Netflix. But in the past, other shows that have become successful, they get syndicated, and as it gets syndicated and as they air on other platforms, the talent would get a portion of those revenues. But those deals were structured differently when it came to streaming services. And so because of that, there is some concern from the writers targeting Netflix, because they see Netflix as a leader of these deals that that have caused them concern for how they are compensated.
How real is the concern that artificial intelligence will be displacing actual writers in the writer room?
I think that a lot of people are concerned about AI. I mean, even in the journalism industry, there's conversations about what AI could do, in terms of impacting writers. But I think it's kind of like, piece of technology that I think is important for people to talk about. I mean, on one hand, there are some aspects of AI that I have heard from others that can be helpful in terms of idea generation, in terms of such as just making tasks a little bit easier, in terms of our everyday lives. But of course, that raises other concerns about, what impact that will do for existing jobs. I think it remains an open question.
Wendy Lee, our guest, reporter for the LA Times, taking a look at the writer's strike, the first since 2007, and what that means for the entertainment industry. And you can join us with your questions and comments about what you might be missing or what you're wondering about this strike at 1-800-642-1234. I say the first thing we've noticed, at least from the entertainment consumption side, Wendy, is the late night shows, the late night talk shows, almost instantaneously once the strike began, were off the air or in reruns. What are some of the other implications for people like me who like to sit down and stream at the end of the day?
Well, I think that most consumers that have streaming services probably won't feel the impact of the strike right away. I mean, we are seeing some shows that were in production that did not have finished scripts shut down, such as season 6 of Cobra Kai on Netflix or the 5th season of Stranger Things. But those are shows that, you know, that were scheduled to go on the platform much farther on into the future. So I think, like, for everyday consumers, a lot of the libraries of the streaming services are so huge that I think there's so many shows that even me personally as a consumer that I follow, I still just don't have enough time to finish yet. Like, I'm still trying to catch up on Picard, I'm trying to catch up on Mandalorian, and then even most recently, I'm also discovering new shows like Doogie Kamealoha MD on Disney Plus. Like, that show was that show released in 2021, but I just saw it like in the library, you know, my Disney Plus content library, and I just started watching that. So I'm not sure if you know, I would think that consumers, it'll be a while, like, for those streaming services to feel it.
For me, it was the second season of Severance on Apple TV Plus that wanted me to find resolution to the writer's strike as quickly as possible.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure the Severance of writers appreciate that.
Well, I'm just interested in what happens next, and there is a lot of that. But what about broadcast television? And a lot of these broadcast TVs now have their own streaming services. But is there concerns over fall lineups and when those might be impacted?
Yeah, no, I think that if this is a, you know, an extended strike, you know, I think that certainly the networks would be impacted. Most of the people that I talk to currently, they are hoping, although, you know, this is just a prediction. No one really knows exactly when the strike is going to end, but I think some of the people that I've talked to think that maybe it might end by, you know, the summer or by like August, I've heard.
Okay.
But as I said, like, no one fully knows exactly when it will end, but it's possible that it might not, the strike might not be as long as the 2007, 2008 strike.
Which was about 100 days, if I remember correctly. But
Yes.
another
Yeah.
thing about that strike, Wendy Lee, was that it seemed to create a vacuum with reality television entering into it. Is this strike affecting our Real Housewives or Below Decks or other reality binge watching?
You know, I was talking with one of the industry analysts about this, and he pointed out that, you know, say for streaming services like Netflix, Netflix over the years has already increased its unscripted shows. So to this industry analyst I talked to, he didn't anticipate like a widespread increase like in that category because the platforms already have invested in that category. But I mean, certainly that's an option, you know, for these companies to do unscripted. And I think, yeah, unscripted, you know, is definitely a possibility for them. I think also, you know, for the studios, one thing that they may also be looking at, according to some analysts I've talked to, is possibly getting, you know, out of overall deals with writers. As in case the labor, in case the work stoppage lasts for a long time, which would result in some form of cost savings to the studios.
Got about a minute left, Wendy, but what are you watching for next in this ongoing strike story?
I think that, you know, a lot of people are going to be watching the negotiations between the studios and the DGA. And I think also just what happens with overall writer deals. You know, I mean, we are hearing about, you know, studios suspending some of these deals. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that as well.
Wendy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Wendy Lee is an entertainment business reporter for the LA Times. We talked to her today about the entertainment industry's impact in the ongoing Writers Guild of America strike. And earlier, we spoke with Michael Childers, professor and co-chair in the Department of Labor Education at UW-Madison, about the labor implications of this strike. And you can still comment online at ideas at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, what makes poverty in America so persistent?
Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of Poverty by America, Matthew Desmond, and invites you to share your stories. Also, prisoners in China are allegedly being forced to make work gloves for a subcontractor of Milwaukee Tool. We'll get the latest from the Milwaukee Watch journalist behind this investigation. It's all coming up tomorrow morning with Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. That's from 7 to 9, right here on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org.